What up, Primers? JC here. Can't get enough of Footy Prime the podcast? Why not head over to Footy Prime's YouTube? Head to youtube.com/footyprime for exclusive video content. Then make your way over to wearefootyprime.com for all things Footy Prime, including our official gear from Admiral and our One Ball Gin from Nickel 9 Distillery. And make sure to follow and subscribe across all platforms, from Twitter to Instagram to Facebook to TikTok. Footy Prime has got you covered for all things footy. Thanks so much for listening, and back to the show. You are now listening to Footy Prime, the podcast, hosted by Danny Dicchio, Craig Forrest, and James Sharman.
Well, hello there, football fans, and look who is back. Not us, you. Look, it's the audience that we let down so badly. This is Footy Prime, the podcast, or the Footy Prime podcast. We'll figure it out as we go along. It's a work in progress, but thank you for joining us. To my right, this guy right here is a man who we once saw Andy Cole reel away in celebration five times in one game.
That's a nice introduction.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
He also, like, single-handedly won Canada's only trophy in football, so yeah, we'll give him that as well.
Had his moments.
Craig Forrest. Beside him, the bald dude who's growing a beard. Love a nice beard, by the way. Not too much grey.
Yeah, it's good to see. Now I'm not on TV anymore. I can grow a beard.
He's a man who adorns Toronto FC's Wall of Honour after almost 2 years as a player. It's Danny Dicchio. Deej?
Hello.
Craig?
Missed you guys.
We've
got to find out an introduction for Sharms now as well, Craig.
I'm no one. Exactly. I'm Mr. Nobody.
Let's dig some dirt on him.
We'll get something.
I'm so boring.
Yeah. Phone the Ukrainians.
But this should be a lot of fun. It's going to be, I hate to say real talk, that's a cliche, but, you know, uncensored football talk. The elephant in the room, of course, is the fact that we are no longer on network TV, at least for the time being. Huh? Hint, hint, nod, nod. Who's watching? Who's listening?
Nudge, wink, wink.
Yeah. Please, dear God, got to pay a mortgage somehow. But, you know, there were many good years at Sportsnet, but the sports media landscape is changing every day. It's almost like the Wild West out there right now, and properties come, properties go. It comes down to financial decisions, and at the moment we're no longer there, but we thank you for joining us on this new project.
Yeah, no, it is great. I mean, from the TV landscape, obviously there's a massive changes going on for cable television, for the movement of sports, different platforms that they're on, and where is that all going? I mean, I just think about the growth of the game from Canada's standpoint. How do we, as a sport, maneuver our way through all these different platforms to continue the growth of the game, which is people aren't going to stumble upon it if it's behind a paywall. So how do we, as a sport again, make it better and make it more accessible to the general public? And we'll try our best to sort of fill that gap a little bit. But there's some good things going on with platforms. I mean, let's not kid ourselves. DAZN is a by, you know, just by definition, by the actual group and the Netflix of sports, it makes sense. Are people getting, the consumer getting everything that they want from it? Is it working properly? These are all other questions, but certainly it's a different world we live in.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think it's the accessibility, Craig, and I go back to, like, this country that I've been in for 12 years now, that I love living in, not having live football on TV for the average Joe to just, as you said, stumble upon or just to watch with his regular weekend. Look, I go back to my dad. My dad's like 70 years old now and he loves turning on his TV. He knows which channel to turn on to. And now you're kind of asking him to log on to a website or to stream a certain site for him to watch his favourite team, whether it be AC Milan or QPR, who are not on TV much anymore, but I just feel we've let kind of the older crew of football fans down, but also the new wave of football fanatics coming through, because not everyone can afford to pay a monthly subscription. Not everyone has the time as well to maybe watch games on streams.
Although I think young kids nowadays, I mean, and this is the issue too, right, is they find their feed somehow without paying for it. Piracy is such an enormous problem for mainstream, you know, broadcasters. And that's, you know, a lot of the reason why we're seeing the changes now. How do you monetize sports nowadays. It's changed so much. But I don't know. I think it's this evolution to streaming, it's not going away. It's the future. Conventional TV is changing. And 5 years from now, we won't recognize TV even now, right?
I think. And when this all, the trickle-down effect of what this is happening, we'll see it in every sport in North America, whether that's the National Hockey League, NBA, or the Premier League, that the rights will go down. If people are feeling that they can't pay these amounts of monies for rights to show the product and they can't get their money back for it, that's going to eventually cost the athletes and the players playing in all these leagues too. Whether we like it or not, these leagues have to help that sort of thing as far as pirating goes. Otherwise, it's going to be very difficult for people to get their money back on a big, big deal. Like the hockey deal is a good example. Sportsnet, $5 billion deal over 12 years. Primarily, that's why a lot of changes have happened at Sportsnet, Rogers, because of the fact that they've got themselves in a deep, deep position with this hockey deal that they're trying to figure out how to make as much money back as they can.
Yeah, precisely. So yeah, it's an evolving. As our studio falls apart here. It's an evolving industry. We'll see what happens. But you know, part of the reason why we're doing this, and you know, it's something we've been planning to do for a couple of years now. We were prevented from doing it before. Now we're obviously free. We're unshackled. Mm-hmm. We can do it. But you know, with less. You know, DAZN, listen, doing a fine job and everything, but there isn't that much analysis beyond the games itself, right? So this allows us to you know, visit the storylines, the hot topics each week on a Monday. It won't be a typical podcast. Listen, if you want to hear, you know, breakdowns of each game, there's some brilliant podcasts out there, right? You know, they're fantastic. We're not doing that. We will be selfish. We'll pick topics that come to our minds each weekend, and we'll just have a chat about it. Various segments, so interviews each week as well. And as we kind of mentioned before about, you know, paying mortgages, if you want to sponsor us, go right ahead. You know, we are sellouts. We are such sellouts.
You are the biggest sellout.
I will be like an F1 race car driver if you want. Happy to wear whatever you want.
I'm going to get an advertisement sticker for your forehead because you got a massive forehead.
Hey, not as big as yours, though, is it, eh?
Come on, I'm back.
Jesus, pot calling the kettle black
head.
There, okay. Eh? Jesus.
Thanks.
Your forehead ends in your ass.
I've called helmet head before. Remember, I played at Cardiff. They absolutely hammered me there.
We played everywhere.
You guys.
Get off my train.
All right, well, listen, let's get to some football talk, shall we? The timing is Man United Arsenal is later today. So there's every chance that by the time you hear this, this game is finished. We hope that United lose. I can finally say that without giving a crap about what I might hear from my bosses. Simply because I love a good crisis. I think a good crisis is good for the game. And United, you had your 20 years of fun, but they are on the verge of a crisis. They're not there yet, I don't think. Maybe they are, but I think it's a little bit early for that. I hope Ole Gunnar actually does succeed because I like Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, but there's some big issues there. But Arsenal, obviously, issues too. As footballers, who would you rather play for at the moment, United or Arsenal?
Ooh, that's a really tough one. I mean, you're right about crisis. Manchester United, there's a lot of fans that have been United fans that have never been through something like this, you know, going through the late 90s, 80s. You know, they're just such a terrific spell with Alex Ferguson, which was just incredible. And I was on the brunt of a few of those games myself. But United is a massive club. I think if I was going to choose between the two, I you know, the history, obviously Arsenal has won two, but I think eventually Manchester United will get it right. But it's hard, you know, to change and to be successful with the squad that they have at the moment when you look at Man City and Liverpool and they're just so far ahead.
Yeah, I think it's not going to be any time soon where we're going to see United contending for titles. I really don't. I think this is not Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's fault. This is the higher-ups at the club that have not directed the club in the right way. And I don't know if that's from the Glazers actually spending money the wrong way or bringing in the wrong coaches at a select time, maybe giving Alex Ferguson too much say within running the club because he's such a prominent figure at that club. And Manchester United, let's not get away from the fact, are in the top three biggest clubs in the world. Even though they're not competing at the moment, their fan base and what they've kind of done over the last 20 or so years has been incredible. I think Arsenal are a totally different club. Like, I have family that support Arsenal. I've got a lot of Arsenal running through my family, and I've got a soft spot for them. They're a club going through transition. They had another prominent figure at their club for many, many years who was very successful, bought a philosophy of style to the football club, was successful during that time. But maybe they hung on to Wenger for far too long as well, mm-hmm. Craig, where they needed to possibly change things around, move him up to a director. We spoke on the show about this numerous times, that he could have moved on a little bit earlier to maybe go through this transition at an earlier stage as well. Because I think Emery is a good coach. I really like his mm-hmm. his tactical approach to games. I think he's still struggling with the language barrier. He's openly come out with that. I still think they're a little bit disorganized. I mean, they've only just found a captain in Xhaka this week.
A player vote, right? In North America, that's not a big deal. A lot of teams have player votes of captains, but there's a lot of controversy about, is that the right thing to do in football? Did you vote for captains when you played, or was it just given by the coach, you are the man with the armband?
Yeah, normally. Mm. And also, it wasn't something that, quite honestly, people thought an awful lot about. Did you think about, like, who was the captain on the team? I mean, you led by example. Everybody and some of the best people that led by example weren't captains.
Yeah. It's totally different over here. We know that in the sports of North America. But in England, it was never kind of thought of. You kind of either joined a club or a team, and there was already someone in place. A guy that had been at that club for a long, long time. An experienced guy that knew not only the club, but the community and the values of what being a captain was. But more often than not, the staff chose a captain that was a leader, not only on the pitch, but also in the locker room and within that group when they were kind of socializing off the field as well. He was kind of the caretaker, the daddy that looked after the younger guys, but also had the respect of the older guys as well. So I think it's a very strange appointment from Emery in letting the players have the autonomy to pick someone like Xhaka. And let's not forget as well, Xhaka is not a favourite player of 60 to 70% of Arsenal fans.
It's been a poor signing so far. Mm. And when he came over, I think a lot of people thought, this is great. This is a young, dynamic leader, you know, has a real substance to him on the field and off the field. But it hasn't worked out for him. It's almost like he tries too hard.
Yeah. Yeah. But it just shows you how much Arsenal are going through this transition still, where they can't find a captain, a leader. Someone that we've been speaking again about on the show, I keep going back to the show, for 10 years, not having that Vieira, not having that Manuel Petit, not having that even earlier Tony Adams, the Stevie Bolds, someone that brought, whether you're a foreign player coming in or a youngster coming through the ranks, brought that team spirit, that togetherness, that made them successful.
But those guys you mentioned all had that element of fear with them too, right? Do you think modern players will answer to a captain who's that fiery? I mean, Roy Keane's the extreme example, right? But even a Vieira, I mean, this is a pretty intimidating character, right?
I think in one of the most important things when you're recruiting these types of players too, in Arsenal, do it on the back of, you know, they're great technical players. They develop really good young players. That's what they're sort of after. They, you know, Wenger left a philosophy of play that that the club will stand by. But the character of the very best players in the world that can consistently do it at the highest level, game in, game out, week in, week out, like the Roy Keynes, were just crazy leadership every single game, never takes a day off. That's another element of a player that makes the difference between a good and great player. And I think that Arsenal have struggled to find that great, great world-class player that has all those different things as well as character.
Well, having said all this, Arsenal's probably going to win 5-0 today. Or United win 6-0 and all this is nonsense because the crisis is over and they're fine.
No, Arsenal have a terrible away record against like top six teams. I don't think they've beaten a top six team in their last 23 like appearances against
when
top
was that?
Six.
Remember the 8-2 result against United? When was that?
But right. When we go back, like, there's been some unbelievable clashes with Arsenal and Manchester United over the years. When we're going back to, like, the Keown, Van Nistelrooy incident.
Pizzagate.
I just feel it's lost that kind of edge about it. And many games have lost their edge about it. Like, the Merseyside derby is not as... Mm-hmm.
Well, if you've got a whole bunch of locals are in the team, but now the foreign influence too. Yeah, the players aren't
damn
thinking.
Foreigners ruin everything, right?
Yeah, they do.
Jesus. They really do, you know. And nowadays you can't go over the ball with 2 feet. Oh, it's wrong. It's dangerous. Yeah, all this, you know, the good old fashioned tackles and violent play on the field are killing derbies. Yeah. They really are. You know, Troy Deeney has been considered a great captain, right, of Watford. Yep. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, he hasn't played that much this year through injury and that, but his team's in the mire, shall we say, coming off that loss last week, 8-0 to City. We all had our eyes on this match against Wolves this weekend. How would Watford respond?
Yeah,
and they lost 2-0, so it's another loss. They are dead last in the table, just 2 points. They fired Javi Gracia. In comes Kike again. Kike. As you say, Leach.
Kike.
Again, and he's hasn't started very well. But I want to talk about teams, how they respond from massive smashings. And it's perfect because we've got a record setter in the studio here.
Got a record for something.
Still holds a record for most goals conceded in a Premier League game. Of course, 9-0 Ipswich United back in 94-95, Craig. Mm-hmm. Now, I was actually a bit unfair on you when I said that Andy Cole scored 5 in one game. It was actually 5 in 65 minutes.
Is that what it was?
It was, yeah, 65 minutes. Now, your next... Actually, it's funny, I Wikipedia'd this game, actually, the 9-0, has its own Wikipedia entry.
Does it really?
It does, yeah.
And it's not something I visit very often.
No, I can imagine. Now, the last sentence in that entry was... the last sentence is, Ipswich goalkeeper Forrest went on to concede a further 7 goals against Manchester United, playing for West Ham in a 7-1 defeat. Yeah.
We scored first. It was 1-0. We made him really angry.
You should have subbed out then, Craig.
Oh, do I wish. People say over in North America, too, they'll also talk about, you know, why didn't they substitute you out? They'll pull the goalie in the NHL.
It wasn't your
NHL.
Fault.
Would you but you never do that,
that
in football, do you?
Hold on.
We got to talk about the tactics before the Man United game.
What
George Burley said? Like, cause
he said they won't expect us to attack. It was 4-0 after 20 minutes.
Let's get out of that.
Yeah. And we're squeezing up at the halfway. Frank Yallop, not the, you know, he's actually quite fast, but not like Giggsy fast. Right? So it was breakaway after breakaway. And then at halftime, we didn't change anything. We didn't just say, let's keep it at 5,
keep going
6. Yeah, we're putting guys
up. We can get this back, lads.
Yeah, they were chasing goal differential too, right? So the difference between the City and Watford game, I think if they had to win 12-0, I think they would have.
Really? So they took the foot off the gas?
They did. Because, I mean, yeah.
9-0?
Well, I mean, you usually get that. You're 3-4 up. The last thing in this part of the season you want is injuries. Yeah. So you just sort of see it out. You know, if you score, fine, move the ball around. But Manchester at that time were, if they were tied with Blackburn, they were quite a ways behind on goal differential. So they tried to catch up. And they did very quickly.
What was the mindset of the team as it went on? I mean, obviously 4-0, 5-0, I mean, you can only imagine, but what was the mentality as a group to begin with of that team, and how did you just fall apart?
Well, at that part of the season, it was getting later in the season, we were pretty much lambs to the slaughter. It's different than Watford early in the season. They just came off a result against Arsenal where they created, I think,
2-2, yeah.
31 2-2. Shots or something. So they're a much better side, technically and mentally, than we are, especially at the start of the season. Now, if this continues for Watford and they end up getting hammered week in, week out, and it gets to the end of the season, you'll see very difficult for the players at that stage that have absolutely been beaten and have lost themselves and lost their way, and it became very difficult for us. We played Tottenham the next game against Klinsmann away. And I think that was 2-0 early, and Klinsmann scored. And I thought
he scored in the second minute.
Right. So now I'm thinking, here we go again. It's going to be 9-0 again, right?
Jesus.
I actually thought about booking a hamstring in.
So what you're saying, at Old Trafford, half of your team basically had their flip-flops on already.
Yes.
Yes.
Well, I mean, after that Spurs game, 3-0, right? Then you lost to Norwich 3-0.
Yeah.
Right? And then 1-0 to Villa. And then 4-0 to Leeds.
Oh, yeah. We didn't score a goal
Jesus.
For weeks.
And then 1-0 to QPR.
Oh.
Right? Close one. And then 4-1 to Arsenal. And then April 17th, you tied West Ham 1-1.
So, oh, yeah, good old hammers.
I mean
that's what nicked his move to West Ham.
That was it, yeah. but these, I mean, people look at the goalkeeper, right? Right, this goes beyond the goalkeeper, right? The team broke, didn't they?
Well, if they do their jobs properly, shouldn't get a shot.
Hold on a minute as well. If we go back to that game, the Old Trafford game, I think if you watch the highlights as well, it was 9-0. And not making the big fella's head even better. It could have been like 12. He pulled off
had a great game.
Three or four unbelievable saves.
The highlight
as well.
Package would be so long because with all the shots and goals, they didn't have time to show any saves. Even the 7-0.
They would have showed it on SportsCenter.
I saved a penalty and they never showed that.
Did you come off the field thinking, you bastards, I had a good game there?
No.
Can you have a good game, Sam?
I thought you conceded
nine.
You missed
a big save, the penalty.
You know what the best part about it was? I stopped looking at the score, and when I walked off the field, I actually thought it was 10.
You thought it was 10?
Oh, yeah. I absolutely positive it was 10. I lost absolute count.
Yeah.
And so on the bright side, I was actually quite happy they didn't hit double figures.
What was the mood of the Man United players at the time? Were they like giggling or were they
bubbly? Oh, yeah. I remember Graham Poole, the referee.
Yeah. I hated that fella.
He was like Naked Gun. He was like Leslie Nielsen every time they scored. Other than taking his shirt off and running around like Gacy.
he was celebrating with him.
Oh, yeah. He was like, Sureka.
Yeah. Thanks, Graham.
Yeah. He was a beauty.
What was the room like post-match? Just dour? Or was it like, man, we're going to go down in history?
No, we didn't say anything. There was absolutely zero said.
It's interesting to note as well, speaking about Watford, Kike Flores this weekend. So normally after a game on a Saturday, Monday is normally your video nightmare. Like they bring the players in before training and they'll go over the good parts, the bad parts of what went on that weekend. The clips would have been made for certain players. The team meeting would have happened. He said after the Watford game against Man City, there was no video. He said the worst thing I could have shown to those players at that time was a video recap of that game. So we had to get on with the week ahead of us.
So when did he make that decision? Because you know that the players for the next few days are thinking it's coming.
Yeah.
And they don't want to have any part of it. They don't want to see it. They knew what they did. And I think that was the best way to take it. How the manager deals with a situation like this is so important. Now, like I said, it's so early in the season, a couple wins by Watford, they could still pull themselves up to mid-table. It's not too late. But how they deal with it, taking responsibility, a certain responsibility about how you go about it, as well as the players take some responsibility too and just face up to it, move on. Quicker the next game comes, the better.
But it's Watford. I mean, Kike's thinking, man, I'm going to be canned next week. He's been there for three games.
Well, that's nature of that club too, right? And eventually, that model, I think, it fails in the end. But you're right. He could be gone. You could be gone at the end of the week easily because that's what they do at that club.
Now when you're 9-0 back in those days, managers weren't quite fired as freely as today. But
George Birdie had just taken over from John Lyle not very long before that, so George was going to be there for the foreseeable.
So he was assessing his players for the next season.
Exactly. Yeah, they won't expect us to attack.
Because that year you went down, right? Four teams went down from that season in the Premier League, didn't they?
Yeah, they did.
They were down to 20 teams.
That's right. Reduced the number of teams.
It's funny because we watched during our Sportsnet days, and whenever there was a big score in the first half, we'd start going, hey up, could
There's
this be the day? This could be it. Hey, this could be it. And Craig, I wonder though, do you want this thing to be beaten, this record?
You know what? I always did want it to be broken.
But now it's a good story.
And now nearly, 17 years after I retired, I get phone calls from the media.
So you're that guy now.
I'm that guy. So I got a call from the Daily Mail, Kieran Gill, and then another guy, Tom Roddy from the Times in London. And they're very tentative when they phone you because they're really wondering, first of all, are you going to be really pissed off by this call? But I know what happens even if I'm not even on the phone. It just, the messages just start coming through. Well, you text me a message, I think five minutes.
So you were in the air at the time, weren't you?
Yeah. Yeah,
I was hoping for you, pal. I was kind of hoping for you. It'd be kind of cool for Craig to no longer hold this record, but where's the fun in that?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, what happens when there's a 10-0 and I become second on the list?
Then no one remembers second place.
No, exactly. So
there you go. So you're that guy for big scores. Who are you that guy for? Do you just like violent play? That kind of stuff?
No,
when there's a leg breaker, then you get phone calls in the mail? And no?
No.
When someone bites someone?
I was a nice player.
Didn't you have somebody on the street actually mentioned something about you about hurting somebody?
Yeah.
And your son was there? And
was that a grocery store?
That was a grocery store. Loblaws here, yeah.
Someone came up
to you? I don't know how we ended up in the same grocery store at the same time, but he was like a Villa fan. I think it was Villa or Birmingham fan. He came up to me and said, I remember I was at the game and you ended Nigel Spink's career. And I still to this day can't remember the challenge or anything what happened. And he says, don't worry, we've been thinking about you for a long, long time. And my son's kind of looking at him, going, what the hell is he talking about, Dad? I said, to be quite honest, I don't know. So we kind of had our altercation, told him to go wherever. But still to this day, people
Nigel
remember.
Nigel Spink, he was a big man.
He was a big man, yeah. Big but man. I still can't
he was
remember.
He's bigger than Leon Spinks.
He was. Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, you must get that a fair amount when you were playing, people coming up to you, I suppose. Less so now, obviously. But, you know, you lived in Ipswich pretty much your whole career, even when you played at West Ham, right?
Right.
You lived in London a lot of the time, obviously, then, you know, up in the northeast there.
Yeah.
What was the worst place to be approached for by fans in the street?
100% Sunderland.
Yeah.
Because you got to remember, London is a massive, massive city. So, like, we could meet someone out on the street today and I never see them again.
You disappear.
Like, right. 18 million people plus living in the London area. You've got like six or so big clubs in the London area as well. Where Sunderland is such a tight little community club where everyone knows you. We used to be in Sainsbury's and people would be following us around looking what you're putting in your shopping trolley. And yeah. We'd be out at certain restaurants if I'd be out with my missus and people would come and interrupt you during your one-on-one dinner with your missus. And that was just the passion and kind of love they had for their club. And if things were going well, it's a very, very good club to play for. But as people and players have kind of found out over the past few years where Sunderland haven't been successful, the fans will let you know. They have no shame in letting you know because they feel that it is their club. It is their club.
I think living in a smaller town, like you grew up in London, so you knew what it was like there. And then when you move to a smaller place, not that Sunderland is overly small, but it's smaller, obviously, and you're under the microscope even more. So Ipswich being 120,000 or 30,000, whatever, I don't know what the GIA would be in the greater Ipswich area, but everywhere you went, it was all on top of you. And I didn't actually appreciate what it was like for people that played in London until I moved to West Ham. Even though I lived in Ipswich, now all of a sudden you're not under the local microscope and playing in there. So I can see why players love London and like to live there and play there because it's a place where you can go missing.
Well, I would say, though, that the clubs where I played, where they were smaller towns, the clubs and the teams I played for, we had a much better team spirit than the clubs that I played for in London. And that was because the players all lived in that area.
Community-driven.
The community, it was driven. We used to socialise in that area. We used to socialise as a team because there wasn't much else that you could do. So it was fully focused around playing for that club, whether it be at Preston North End, where we had a really good team spirit, where at Sunderland, for instance, as well. And I really, really enjoyed that period of my career.
But so it goes both ways, though, right?
It
can be great when things are going well, but it goes bad, you stay in.
Yeah.
Basically. Just stay in.
Yeah.
You made up your decision what you're going to do on a Saturday night by the result. So at 5 o'clock, you would decide what you're going to do, whether you're going to stay in or go out.
And rightly so. You're still seeing, like, I mean, you look at Lindegaard and people like that at the moment that are on social media, and I think that rubs fans up the wrong way. And there's a little bit of, yes, they're human, so they have to live their lifestyles. But there's also, I think, you have to behave as a professional and respect the fans and the club, whether you've just been dubbed 4-0 somewhere or lost at home or drawn at home. The fans don't have a right to say what you should be doing with your life, but there's also a little bit of humility to say, okay, I'm going to have an easy night in tonight, I'm going to order a takeaway and just watch
a game. But be smart about it, right? If you in a bad stretch, don't start, you know, tweeting about your fashion lines.
Exactly.
Right? Be smart about it. Now, in the player's defense, nowadays, most players have to have a Twitter account or a social media profile. The clubs tell them have to.
Yes.
To promote the club as well, right? So it's what you do with it. And a lot of these guys have their accounts obviously managed by someone else.
Yeah.
Someone that doesn't know that United lost to Arsenal 4-0 and then their management team tweeted out from Jesse Lingard's account, you know, I've got a great new pair of pants I'm selling now.
Well, he's going to be
right? It's not always his fault. It looks bad optically, but be smart about it. You know, control the message. And that's what I think
there's
a lot of players
fail to do. The social media thing is something we didn't have to deal
with. Can you imagine?
No, I couldn't imagine.
Could you imagine cameras and phones when you guys played?
Right, yeah. And then just the fact that even if you have a good game, if you go read the thread about what's going on. It's just coming at you sideways. So players have to deal with that too. And that's another
Did you read element. The papers when you played? Match reports?
Of course, yeah.
You did, yeah?
The next day, that's what you looked at.
Yeah.
Did not matter how well you played or how bad you played. You kind of were looking the next day at the mark, what you would get in the Sun or the News of the World or the People, wherever it was, the Sunday papers. And you kind of gravitated to what that's that true. Person
player ratings
had given Jesus. You. And you were like, yeah. I thought I was a little bit better than a 5.
Yeah. And you know he's just randomly just going out.
Yeah. Fella probably didn't even watch the game, but like you're saying, yeah, Dickie, I've got.
I always
5.
Wondered why if I didn't have anything to do in a game, which wasn't very often, and I would get a 6.
Right.
And you think, well, I didn't do anything. I don't deserve a 10.
Yeah, but you did that really well.
But I didn't. Yeah, exactly.
You
I
stood
did
around.
Nothing really, really well.
Yeah, you applauded. Had the
yeah,
you know, good encouragement to the lads.
Oh, but as Craig said,
organised the corner well.
All we had to really deal with was either the wrath of the manager's full-time speech in the changing room, to the papers the next day getting a certain grade out of 10.
Yeah,
but nowadays, like, most players are on Twitter. Most managers are on Twitter now, so they're assessing, looking what the trend or the thread is of the game. Then you're personally getting attacked by away team fans, then your whole team, home team fans, if the result hasn't gone well. So you have to have a really thick skin now. And I think
and the owners are watching.
And
this
the owners
too.
Are watching.
So they get a lot of pressure from the fans.
The players are a different breed now. Like, you have to be very sensitive to what you're saying. I mean, we speak about Chris Wilder and Sheffield United's post-game talk as well, Sean. But there's a real balance now in how you portray your message, I think.
See, Chris Wilder should be on Twitter and actually tweeting. He'd be amazing. He's like a straight-laced northerner, right? And he'd be amazing. I think out of all the managers in the Premier League, who would I want to hear on Twitter? He might be right up there, I think, because he wouldn't give a shit, right? He'd just say whatever the hell he wants whenever he wants, right?
He certainly...
Well,
speaks off the cuff.
Let's talk about that, shall we? So this weekend there were actually some real howlers by goalkeepers. But in the big ones in the Spurs game, Lloris with that awful one, and then poor old Dean Henderson for United. They played really well apart from those moments, but of course they remember for those moments. But let's hear from Dean Henderson. Sorry, about Dean Henderson from Chris Wilder post match. Let me figure this out, and of course now it's gone. Christ's sakes. We'll get to it. This is called technology, people. We'll get to it eventually. But essentially, he threw his goalkeeper somewhat under the bus and his players after losing 1-0 to Liverpool. Mm. It was a frustrating performance, of course, in the end, because he says that the Reds were there for the taking. Do you think they really were?
Well, he also said there was an off day, and he even alluded to the Norwich result against Man City, that Man City weren't at their best.
Yeah.
Norwich scored on every opportunity, 3 shots, 3 goals. And pull off a massive result. Was it there for Sheffield United? Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. I mean, the fact that they get outplayed, that's beside the point. But they had the chances, and the goalkeeper let a really soft one in. Did they deserve to win? Probably not. But could they have won the game? Absolutely. And those are the games when you have the best teams in the league, you feel disappointed that you let yourself down, that you didn't take those chances.
I thought they played fantastically. I really was impressed with them. I thought they had really good chances. They limited Liverpool to a certain amount of chances where normally Liverpool run over teams with the attack that they have. And it was interesting what he said. He said, look, we could go toe-to-toe with Liverpool and we would have got opened up, like, you don't know. But we organised ourselves with a structure in a way where we would still hurt them but try and limit their chances on net. But I'm a little bit kind of dubious in the way that he came out after the game, and I'll speak about it after. Have you got it on?
Yeah, here it is. Let's hear now from Chris Wilder after his team had just lost 1-0 to Liverpool.
And yet again, both ends of the pitch have cost us. Dean's, you know, not made a routine save, and you know, he absolutely I crack up when, you know, ex-players say, well, you shouldn't chuck your players under the bus. Well, it's difficult to hide. When you're playing worldwide football in the Premier League, that your goalkeeper should make a save. And Leon Clark should score, John Fletcher should score, John Lundstrom should score. And we've had another couple of opportunities. And so I expect...
So there you have it. It's not often you hear a manager really come out and single out players, especially a goalkeeper. Was he right to do that, do you think? I mean, is it an individual thing? Can the player take it? Can he not take it? Or was this just an angry manager ranting post-match?
I didn't really think. I've seen a lot worse. I've seen a lot worse. And I think, honestly, in the dressing room, he would have said exactly the same thing. The goalkeeper doesn't need to be told he made a mistake. He knows he made a mistake.
Yeah.
The players had opportunities to score. They know. They know that. And you can't get away from it. I think he's probably emphasized the fact that you're in the Premier League. This is a completely different animal than it was in the division below. Like, it, you know what it's like. I mean, you're completely gone from just local people knowing what you're doing and very small numbers of television viewers to everything you do, 32 cameras, and you can't shy away from it. And I think he was a little bit miffed by the question too, because he said, how did you console your players? Well, console your players? I don't, you know, what do you mean console my players? Everybody can see from watching the game that these things happened. And I didn't think it was all that bad.
See, from my point of view, I believe that at the beginning of the year or when a head coach comes in, he sets the standards for what's going to happen in the press and the media. And that goes two ways, for players to start speaking out in the media about tactics or what's going on the training pitch. And I used to love playing for Peter Reid because whatever was said was closed in the changing room. So he said, look, we're going to fall out with disagreements, opinions, but whatever said is in the confinements of the changing room here, and it doesn't get out. So whatever needs to be said will be said, as you said, to the goalkeeper, Henderson, at the weekend, the players that missed their chances. I don't believe you need to go out into the press or to the media to put that message out again, because for me, that's just letting the fans and the media know that, okay, I'm the boss and I'm going to tell everyone. It's kind of a little bit ancient with that. That was old school football.
But he's now owned the message now. Now it's out there. There's no point talking about it anymore. The goalkeeper knows he's screwed up. The fans know he's screwed up. The manager knows he's screwed up. And now, okay, done. Put a line under it. Let's move forward. Is that maybe part of what it is? Almost like closure? Okay, now I've dealt with it. Don't ask me about it anymore. Move on.
Maybe, but the closure was in the changing room beforehand. You know, so the players would... The goalkeeper doesn't need to be told the mistake he made. You could see straight after the goal, he's put his hands on his head and he knows he made a massive mistake. Mm-hmm. The players that missed the chances, there was a glorious chance late on, I think it was Robinson or someone that put the ball over the bar. He knows he missed that chance. Should he do better? Of course he does. And Wilder talks about it. Look, we're players that want to play in the Premier League week in, week out. Mm-hmm. You have to put them chances away. You have to make that save. Yeah. But we saw Lloris make a terrible mistake in possession of the ball, but he pulls off two world-class saves to keep Spurs in the game and winning 3 points with 10 men.
Amazing saves.
There's a balance there.
I think the Dean Henderson one was a worse mistake because it's a basic save.
Yeah.
Lloris, he gets caught in possession on the ball.
Yeah.
That's just being, you know, switched on. You've taken risks where you're not supposed to as a goalkeeper, and he knows all this better than anybody. He's a World Cup winner. But that's what you put that down to. It's just he thinks he was better with his feet than he
and I mean, in Dean Henderson's case as well, this is a guy on loan from Manchester United.
Yeah.
You know, he's a very ambitious guy by all accounts. He thinks he can be very, very good, one of the top keepers, you know, in his profession. So maybe this is a case of a manager who knows he's not there for the long term, saying, I need to get the most out of my keeper in the short term. You know, I can't have my goalkeeper on loan making mistakes like that.
Mm.
You know, so pull your socks up, son.
Well, that's true. I mean, he's you're not playing for fun anymore, and mistakes like that, like again, are just under the microscope like never before. How he deals with that, it's different than certainly a Ben Foster conceding 8.
Who's
34 years of age, who has played 300, 400 games already. He's played for England. I think he can manage that mentally a lot better than a Dean Henderson possibly could at his age. But that will be interesting to see how he bounces back from that. And a lot of scouts and people at Manchester United, well, everybody will be looking at that too. Because, again, we talk about character as players as being one of the biggest elements of the profession. Seen some of the greatest goalkeepers technically in training, but they can't handle 30,000 people telling them that they're shite.
Right, right, yeah, of course.
You know,
well, it's a good point. I think we take that for granted as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think he mentions the worldwide Premier League in his comments there, right? And I think that's by design in many regards, is high pressure environment. For you guys, you played many years at the top level of English football. Did it ever become overwhelming that, Christ, we're in the Premier League right now? You know, I've got the world's eyes right now watching me at the moment. Did it ever come, or was it just natural for you? You were fine with it, you could brush it off.
Well, quite honestly, if you didn't enjoy it and enjoy the feelings of, you know, anxiety and nervousness, you know, approaching games, you shouldn't be there, and you probably wouldn't be there, won't be there very long. You'll, you know, dip and whatever. But I actually loved it. I loved every second of it, and that was always my goal to, as players playing and your kids, to reach that echelon, you know, to get in there. And as soon as I made my first appearance in '92 in the inaugural year, I was just. They can't take that away from me. I've played at the top level, and you just want to stay there. And, and people always said, what game sort of stood out to you? And I was like, there wasn't one that stood out.
Well, there was one or two.
But it's amazing to remember the bad ones. But,
yeah, I know, it's
you
true,
know,
right?
But overall, I mean, if I had the chance to go back and, you know, concede 9 at Man United, probably wouldn't want to do that, but 7. You know, just to get back out on Old Trafford again and walk out on that field.
But you
to
also
do
got,
it again?
You also got results there too, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
right,
yeah,
which you don't talk about.
Yeah, yeah, no, exactly. Went in the FA Cup, 0-0 with John Lyle there. We played without a striker. It was negative football, which I remember Alex Ferguson wasn't happy with John, because John Lyle coming from the, you know, Academy of Football at West Ham and Ron Greenwood and all these great managers in the past and how he liked to play, it was really quite negative from his standpoint. But we got a point, yeah.
Were you ever overwhelmed, Deitch, or was it
no,
just kind of
because I was thrown in at such a young age. You're not thinking about anything else.
Where, yeah, fearless.
Right. You're fearless. You're not thinking about like your family or if things don't go right. You're not thinking about I've got a mortgage to pay if I don't perform right. You're playing with so much freedom, and I wasn't even kind of aware of me being thrown in. Jerry Francis threw me in against Man City, who were flying high at the times, and then I made my Premier League debut at home against Aston Villa, and I scored, and it was just a whirlwind of. Holy shit, I'm really here. I'm playing. I've been out on loan to like Welling non-league. I've been on loan to Barnet, where they probably were assessing me to see if I was ready.
Or you really don't know one, or well, you don't want to play.
You don't want to play. So maybe that was a good platform for me to say, all right, I've really got to discipline myself and myself off the field, on the field, to really push through and try and get in the first team. And I had some great leaders, experienced captains within the group. Ian Holloway, Les Ferdinand, guys like that have been around for a long time, Ray Wilkins, and they brought me into the group and just said, look, play with freedom, show your natural talent. And it was just a whirlwind of
you
emotion.
You didn't have much. But.
No, exactly. And like,
but you had swagger, right? I mean, at that point, you know, to get to that point when you've been training with the first team, you know, you must have had enormous confidence in yourself as well, that I belong here. Or was it ever?
It wasn't so much
yourself?
That I belonged there. Like I remember one of my first training sessions where I got into the first team, and it was Ian Holloway and Gary Penrice at the time pulled me aside, and I played in the reserves with both of them, and they knew of me. But the nervousness for a young player going into the first team is always difficult. But once you know a couple of players that you're going into. Join, it made it a little bit easier for me. But both of them pulled me and said, listen, you haven't done jack shit. The manager is not even going to look at you in training. He's assessing his first team starting players. So he says, all you have to do is remember that whatever you've done so far, you have to work twice as hard to consistently stay here. And it was a good piece of advice for me, because I think some young players now get into the first team picture and they suddenly open their shoulders a little bit. They start listening to everyone around them that you should have this sponsor, you should have this now, you're in the first team picture, instead of really focusing on, I've got to work twice as fucking hard now to stay within this group.
Right.
And the head coach is not even looking at me yet. I'm basically just a training number, and if called upon for an injury or suspension, then I'm going to get my opportunity. So
well, you even mentioned about going to Welling.
Yes,
and,
non-league.
You know, non-league. And a lot of people don't realize that, too. I mean, in your road to try to get to the first team, it didn't just happen.
Right.
It wasn't an easy road. A lot of times you have to take a step backward. I went to Colchester, which was in the fourth tier at that time. So as a 19-year-old, going down there and playing in the league, great experience.
And you're playing with guys that are either journeyman or haven't made it to the top level.
Yeah. And they're 35 years of age and they've done nothing.
You're not playing for the reserves at West Ham or Ipswich or QPR, where I was, where you're playing with kind of similar guys around you. You're playing with guys that are working week in, week out to get win bonuses. That the actual game at the weekend means something. Yeah. It's 3 points to...
Yeah. And £50 bonus.
And £50 bonus. So, like, it was a perfect environment for me to kind of learn my trade with older vets around me and playing against opponents that wanted to kick me 6 foot up in the air, thinking I was this flash boy from London, skinny boy with long hair. Yeah. We're going to actually show you what real football is, lad.
Yeah.
And it was, as I said, I don't think that experience is experienced enough for a lot of our younger players growing up. A, in this country, in North America, but also still back home in England, where this under-23 league is kind of, I wouldn't call it a posy league, but they're not getting the real experience of playing with players that need to fight for their spot, but also need to fight for points for their club and their community week in, week out.
Some clubs have a philosophy of sending a lot more players, young players, on loan, right? Remember Harry Redknapp when he moves to Spurs? He was like, why don't I play in a reserve league? I'll send him out to... lower division
Colchester,
teams,
Leighton Orient,
right?
Yeah.
And can actually have a crowd and experience the a little bit of the professional angle of things that really puts you in good stead later on.
Yeah, no, it's interesting, and I'm sure we'll get into a lot of this over the coming weeks and months on this show. But it's a good segue into our next segment, which is called Room 442. Generally speaking, we'll have a guest on at this point from around the footballing world, but this week for the first show. I thought I'd keep you boys around for this segment. And going from when you first started playing, I think the viewers and listeners want to hear a little bit about your careers and how it ended. There's a bit of murkiness about both your careers, how they ended and when they ended and why and who told you, et cetera. So let's get into that briefly before we move on here. Craig, let's start with you. You just won the Gold Cup in 2000, right? You're playing high. Everything was great. National icon at that point. Even Christ Canada winning a medal, a trophy, something else. But then... Of course, a year or so later, it all went pear-shaped.
Yeah, I got nut cancer, testicular cancer, a little bit more technical.
that wasn't the actual doctor's. No. By the way, great bad news.
Yeah,
you got nut cancer.
I remember I was training actually, and I was telling the guys I had to go to see the doctor because I got a lump, and so off I went, and then literally within 24 hours they had whipped it out.
That quick?
Wow. Literally went back to hospital in the Ipswich area and they got it dealt with very, very quickly. So then I went on to basically go away for the club for, 8 months or so like that. And I was in the last year of my contract. So my agent, Jonathan Barnett at the time, who's Gareth Bale's agent, so he's done all right there. We were trying to get a 2-year extension as opposed to a 1-year. I was 34, you try and push it a little bit. And that was kind of in the negotiations. And then went away, obviously, when I went through treatment and chemotherapy. And then after that, I went back and Harry Redknapp had just left. Glenn Rhoda had taken over. And when I came back to start regaining, fitness again, the agent, Jonathan, said, well, just under the circumstances, with a year, we'll just take the year extension and Craig will prove his fitness. And they said the offer's been taken off the table. So, that's the reality of football. And
But at that point, how did you feel? Like betrayed?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And the club weren't going to do anything to support in any way from that moment. And I had a lot of good help from Stuart Pearce, Steve Lomas, John Moncur, Don Hutchison, some great guys at the club that sort of forced the club to try to help me in some way, which they did at that point from some of the player power. But that was, it wasn't the way I wanted to end. And then in the end, you're kind of forced into a forced retirement, even though I wasn't quite ready. I thought I could prove my fitness at 35. Again, nobody wanted to take you at that point because you're damaged goods.
So no one even gave you a trial?
Well... I wasn't prepared to go at 35 back on trial, to be honest.
Right.
And playing at the top end, I was, would have tried to challenge that myself with that again, but that didn't look like a possibility. So I decided to do TV, which was It's a lot easier.
Yeah, a lot easier. But I mean, I think at some point we'll do a show dedicated to this topic entirely. I think there's so many layers to it, right?
And your story, it is a good topic too, because there's a lot of players that we played with and have gone through really, really tough times about the retirement side of things. We sort of had something, you know, straight from you to fall back on, and you know, not have your umbilical cord cut to stay in the game and a reason to be involved. And the TV did that, so it was a nice transition from playing. But a lot of guys, you know, hundreds of guys that are released every year, they struggle.
But you, you retired, and it wasn't really on your terms. I mean, you were dealt a terrible blow, and you think the game would have given you a break, for Christ's sakes, given you a chance. I mean, it's been 17 years now, Craig, but I mean, it's still got to be pretty painful, I would think, when you look back and actually think about the details of those times.
Well, sure, but at the other hand, I was just happy that I got through it, and health-wise, and, you know, maybe I would have got a two-year contract and I wouldn't be here anymore.
Yeah,
so that's not going to do me any freaking good.
Deitch, you retired when you came to TFC. No, sorry, 2 years after you came to TFC. I'm joking. Different era. But
nudge, good one. Good low blow there, Shams.
No, but in fairness, you know, I don't say many nice things about you guys. I won't in this podcast, but you are still an icon at TFC, okay? And I remember when you first signed there, it's like, holy crap, Danny Diccio, I remember him. Yeah. Pretty good player, right? and he did really well in the 2 years. But towards the end of your career, you know, you missed more and more games with a back injury, right, I think, wasn't it, mainly? Was it on your terms in the end when you stepped aside?
No, not really. I'd had two back operations in my career. The first one was a major one, and the second one was kind of a clean-up. But as a tall 6'4" player traveling a lot in North America, which you unfortunately have to do, things started to deteriorate with my... just my personal health as well, and being able to perform week in, week out. The coach at the time thought that I couldn't travel to the West Coast for certain games where I thought I was able to, and we kind of fell out over that. And then it was on, I think it was in 2009, we were away in Colorado, and Mo Johnson pulled me and he said, listen, we need to free up a roster spot. Have you thought about retiring? And I'd already spoken about that this was going to be my last year in 09. The club knew that I was completing my coaching badges. I'd already done my UEFA B in England, and I'd started to do my USSF A and B. So he basically came to me in the middle of the season when we were in Colorado and said, look, we've got Julian de Guzman coming in as a designated player that we have to free up a roster spot. It was nothing to do with money or anything, because it wasn't even close to being a DP player. So I had to think about it very, very quickly, because they needed a decision made by that Sunday. And it was Saturday in Colorado, and that was basically going into that game thinking this is going to be my last ever game as a football player. So that was pretty emotional for me at the time. It was emotional as well because I didn't get to play a home game in front of the Toronto FC fans, which obviously I had a really good relationship with. So it was kind of unfortunate the way my career fizzled out, because I would love to have played at home. But I also look back on things as well, and I had many good instances in my career, whether it be at Toronto FC, whether it be at Preston, where I kind of...
all things said and done, it's a long career in professional sports.
It was a long career. Yeah, so, and we both were very fortunate in having long careers. Some players have injuries or some kind of health problems where they don't get to see out their career. So very fortunate in that. But I would have liked to have finished in a different way. I really would. But I can't say enough how much the club have helped me and my family settle here in Canada. They offered me the position as coaching with the first team as an assistant. Then they knew I wanted to look after my own team, and they said, you're a big part of the younger players and how they look up to you at the club. So would you like to work in the academy? I said, that works perfectly with me. So yes, upset at the time, but I got over it pretty quickly. And it was actually pretty recently, I think it was like, literally 10 years ago to the day that I retired.
Was it really?
Yeah.
Yeah? Wow. Yeah, so. We should do a whole show on the Mo Johnston era, is it? here at TFC. That'd be interesting, wouldn't it?
That would be good.
But I guess very few footballers really retire really on their terms, because this is something you've only known this your whole life, pretty much.
Yeah.
And you're playing football. I understand the pressures, but my God, that's a pretty sweet life, right?
It's harder in the transition than it is actually the moment.
Yeah.
You know, what am I going to do? How am I going to do it? Do I want to stay in the game? Do I want to get into coaching? Do I want to get into broadcasting?
And
a lot of decisions to make that are kind of scary at that time. But, I mean, blessed, really fortunate. So.
Well, I've certainly enjoyed my retirement so far.
Yeah.
It's been great summer. Hey? If you're going to get laid off, right, do it early in the summer. Because it's been fantastic, you know. I've got a tan like Dickio right now. It's great.
Yeah.
The patios of Toronto have been loving Sean's retirement.
Yeah. I'm just very happy that the missus earns. Otherwise, we'll be in trouble. Okay, listen, let's move on now. We're almost at the end of the first show here, fellas, but we're going to have a little segment here what we'll do each week called The Big Question. He might sound familiar to a segment we had for a couple of years in our Premier League coverage at Sportsnet. But this time, you know, looking ahead, looking forward to the week that's going to come here, is there one question that you want answering in the next few days? Let's start with you, Deej. What's your big question this week?
I think after yesterday's game, Newcastle's performance against Leicester, my big question is, does Steve Bruce last till Christmas? The fans were not happy with him, with his appointment. Listening to Sam Allardyce this morning on Talk Sport in England saying that he was approached to take the job, but he didn't feel it was right. He feels that Steve Bruce was the right guy, a local guy, taking over from Rafa Benitez. But boy, oh boy, things are not looking good at the moment. And the way they surrendered yesterday had a red card, but...
Oh, God, it was over. It you was, could tell yeah, there was no
for
coming
me,
back.
It's just kind of negative football at the moment. And they've got some exciting players going forwards, but the way... set up to play games tactically, it's just very, very negatively. And I go back to the Keegan days where he's the messiah back there, and Bobby Robson, they played attacking football where they conceded goals. Yes, sometimes Keegan said, look, if we're going to win games, we're going to win it by scoring goals. If we have to win 4-3, we have to win 4-3. But the punters and everyone will go home happy, and the players will enjoy playing for me. Mm. And I just feel that at the moment, like even with Benitez at times, they were negative, but they were proactive in getting results, where at this moment I'm looking at the way they're set up, they're so negative with their approach, and they don't even look like scoring at the moment. And you have players like Almiron in the team, they have exciting players going forward, but
they lose, you know, Perez, and they lose Rondon. I mean, for God's sakes, that's a lot of goals from last season gone from the team. I mean,
well, they spent a lot of money on the Brazilian player as well,
Joe Lilton,
who's struggling at the moment to be effective. Mm. But are we really blaming him, or are we blaming the tactics? We don't know what's going on.
There's always been something around Newcastle, isn't there? Yeah. Always. You're talking about the ownership, the managers.
It's been 10 years now, right? With Dashing now, right? Almost?
Yeah.
Almost 10 years. I mean, and they hate him up there.
Yeah.
But that performance, 5-0 to admittedly a really good Leicester team, was embarrassing yesterday. Yeah. So it's,
Brendan Rodgers had done well.
Has he ever? Good manager.
So really do you think really Bruce lost till Christmas?
No.
No?
No. I don't.
Well,
I don't see well.
Is a club going to be sold before Christmas? Well, maybe that's
the
bigger question
that
right
for
now.
2-3 years
I know.
Well.
I think the fans would be happy.
But
with
Steve
that.
Bruce comes in, what, 2 or 3 weeks before the season begins? You miss essentially pre-season.
Yeah,
what the hell can the guy do? Right? I mean, he took the job. He didn't have to. But, I mean, he's on a hiding to nothing, isn't he? Really?
Yeah.
Good thing they had that Spurs result.
Yeah, no kidding. Craig, what's your big question?
Will Liverpool win the league?
In the next week? Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Of course. Actually, we've got one of our listeners, viewers, sent a tweet. He asks, how many trophies will Liverpool finish with this season? And is Jordan Henderson the greatest captain in Premier League history? No, he's not. He's the second best, because Steven Gerrard was the best. And they'll win 4 trophies. There's your answer there. That's
hold on.
That's a Scotty.
How are they
going to
win
Burnsome.
4 trophies if they're getting kicked out of the Carabao
Cup?
I
know. Good point, actually. Huh? Is that a good thing or a bad thing, though?
Yeah,
so essentially, if you haven't heard it, they could be kicked out for fielding an ineligible player in the last round. They thought he had an international license.
They
turns out
care.
He didn't.
They don't care,
right?
The only thing they would care about is it's an opportunity for some up-and-coming players to play in that cup. which is great yeah. experience for
which
them.
Most clubs use it for now.
Right,
but
yeah,
I really think Liverpool are going to go for the league title this year. They've ticked off the Champions League box. Klopp's finally won that trophy after trying to win it for so many years mm-hmm. with either Dortmund or Liverpool. I just think they're going to go, but never write off Man City. I'm yeah, telling you,
I know.
Never write yeah. off Man City.
They could win 30 in a row.
Yeah,
yeah they could. I, you know, I'm happy to admit my allegiance to Liverpool. Of course, most people probably know that by now. I don't hide it, and this is as good as we'll ever see them. Perhaps
it's
still
amazing.
Think City with their depth might just be enough. I know it's 5 points right now, but it's a long season. Yeah. Right? So much
you
can
know,
happen.
I gotta say, Klopp has done an amazing job, and so has Pep. You know, in Manchester. But see what Klopp's done and how he's put that team together, and they've spent a lot of money on a couple of individuals that have just made the team, you know, brilliant.
I believe this is the last year that we're going to see a fight between Man City and Liverpool, because rumours coming out of England yesterday is that this is Pep's last year at Man City. I also feel that if Liverpool don't win the title this year, I think there could be some movement from some players, because they're being touted by the likes of Real Madrid, Barcelona, Mane, Salah. So I think they need to win the title.
Oh,
this
I hate
year.
That, man. I know you're probably right, but I just hate that whole thing in modern football. Yeah. I haven't won here. I'm going to move on. How about you bloody fight for a trophy? Stick with it. Show some goddamn loyalty for crying out loud. Loyalty.
What I would say though, when
am
you
I talking
look,
about football here?
When you look at the Liverpool team and the Man City team, like I read an article this week about Jurgen Klopp and the way he. His style, his philosophy, and the way he kind of takes results on the chin, whether they win or lose, he's always got a smile on his face. And the way he thinks of his players as well, how like they've been through so much hardship, and his growing up in Germany compared to the likes of Mane and Salah and what they've got from Mino in getting to where they are today. So you can really see the way these players play for Liverpool Football Club is all stemmed from the way the manager approaches his team management is fantastic.
Amazing.
His passion for the game is fantastic as well. And it's in correspondence to the way the City players play for Pep. They know that he's a genius with not only his tactical approach, but the way he handles certain situations.
Yeah.
But I just feel it's going to be another fantastic race. What, they won 7 on the bounce now, Liverpool?
Yeah.
They're trying to go for Mourinho's record at Chelsea of 9 on the bounce. I think they can
start
do that.
A season.
They start
won
a season,
a
yes.
A bunch last season as well, right?
Yeah.
I think it's a 16 now.
Yeah.
Okay, my big question is, this week the Maradona documentary comes out, HBO.
Looking forward to it, yeah.
Yeah, and I just want to know, will it be the greatest sports doc of all time? Because people are saying it is. Now, the guy who produced, directed Asif Gaddafi, he did Amy Winehouse's, he's a fantastic director. I'm really excited about this. And will it paint Maradona in the right light? What that light is, you decide.
There's been some good documentaries. George Best documentary was very
fantastic,
good.
Fantastic, yeah, brilliant. I love good sports doc, me.
I will still never, ever forgive Diego Maradona. Scumbag. He made me cry like
for
a
that
little
reason.
Baby for a long, long time.
Yep.
And I will still never, ever forgive
Imagine
him.
Imagine if VAR was around then, Deitch. We could have won
we'd
the World
Cup
that year. Yeah, of course, but not the previous one, though.
No, not the previous one.
No. It crossed the line, damn it. All right, fellas, we're out of time. We've gone heavy as it is. We thank you for listening, and assuming people are listening and watching, maybe no one is. Maybe it's just us.
It's nice having a chat.
It's nice. It's good
it's
to be
good
back.
Seeing you guys again.
It really is, yeah. We'll do it every Monday. Footy _ Prime is the Twitter address. Find us on Facebook as well. YouTube. More and more platforms as time goes on. It's a work in progress. We will be having also, this is exciting, we're hoping maybe once a month to do a live podcast from Betty's, which is one of my favorite bars in Toronto here. More details will come as we finalize them, but sorry, what's it, Dan?
Eggplant picture in sand.
Yeah, I was getting to that. I was getting to that, for Christ's sakes. Jesus, that's Dan Wong, by the way.
Thank you.
From
eggplant picture in sand. But they have made this whole thing possible. So direct your anger at them. Not so much us. But listen, this will start small and hopefully get large and big. But fellas, it's been a long time coming. We've been discussing this for probably a couple of years, right?
Yeah.
I think. And now it's come to reality. So there'll be more and more segments as the weeks and months go on, including hearing from you, the listener, the viewer.
Yeah.
We want to appease the scum, basically, and give you a chance to mouth
You're
off
nice,
your opinions.
Yeah. That's a nice way to call your viewers.
All right, fellas. Hope you enjoyed that, everyone.
Thanks, everybody.
And Craig, Danny, Dan, cheers for joining me today, and cheers for listening, everyone.
What up, Primers? JC here. Can't get enough of Footy Prime the podcast? Why not head over to Footy Prime's YouTube? Head to youtube.com/footyprime for exclusive video content. Then make your way over to wearefootyprime.com for all things Footy Prime, including our official gear from Admiral and our One Ball Gin from Nickel 9 Distillery. And make sure to follow and subscribe across all platforms, from Twitter to Instagram to Facebook to TikTok. Footy Prime has got you covered for all things footy. Thanks so much for listening, and back to the show. Show.